In our busy daily lives, we forget, I think, that nearly everything around us and on us is transported across the oceans in large multicoloured containers stacked up high on ships, carrying nothing else except its skeletal crew. It's a tradition, or it comes from a tradition that has continued for centuries, this whole notion of trade, but the newer version has truly transformed the way we interact with other cultures, indeed how we blend them. So what are conditions like at sea these days? We hear a great deal, for instance, about Somali pirates, but how do you navigate defensively against them? How has the business of carrying freight changed over the centuries? Who are the people who bring these goods to our docks? Maya Jasanoff is a professor of British history at Harvard University, and she has recently travelled on one of these freight ships. She kept a blog of her experience travelling from Hong Kong through to Southampton in the UK, and she joins me now with her feet planted firmly on the ground. Welcome to Saturday Extra, Maya.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like to read the start of a review you wrote in the New York Review of Books of another freighter passenger's book. But this is what you wrote about your first experience. Imagine the Empire State Building. Now imagine it tipping on its side, nudging it into the Hudson and putting out to sea. That was the scale of the thing I contemplated one day in late November as I gaped at the immense Navy hull of CMA CGM Christoph Colombo, one of the world's largest container ships, which stretched above and out of sight on either side of me on a quayside in Hong Kong. Did the scale of the ship make you feel apprehensive about hopping aboard, or did it make you feel safe?
You know, well, the first thing I have to say is I wasn't even sure where I would hop aboard, because it suddenly occurred to me that looking at this thing, I had no idea how you even got onto it. So I had to be gestured in the right direction and then climb up, you know, I guess about 8 flights of stairs equivalent even to get on. But there was a degree to which the size, I guess this is the legend of the Titanic living on, the size does seem to be some sort of defense against the elements. And obviously these ships are so big that they're not as prone to the kind of tossing and turning that you might get in older ships or smaller ships.
Oh, is that so? It's funny, I imagined it might be worse, that it would be, you know, I'm thinking of that tragic story of the ferry toppling over in Korea, that it might be more prone to instability.
You know, I think a lot depends on how these ships are designed and how they're loaded. But certainly one of the big transformations in shipping since, let's say, 100 years ago has been the advent of containerization, you know, the packing of all of the cargo into these boxes that we now see everywhere we look, it seems. And as a result of this, the loading of ships has become, in fact, I think a lot more streamlined and a bit safer, because back in the day when every bundle of thing had to be shoved and wedged into the hold piece by piece, there was a great risk that the loading could go wrong, particularly if the people loading judged it poorly. Now, of course, there are computerized models to make sure that everything is maximized for the most efficient passage.
And they have this carrying capacity of 13,344 TEUs, or 20-foot equivalent units, the size of a container. And you have this great little description, which means it would take a line of trucks nearly 50 miles long to drive away with a shipload of cargo. That was an incredibly helpful description for me, just to grasp the scale of what's at stake.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, these containers, you know, sometimes one sees them repurposed on land for dwelling units. So imagine each one the size of, let's say, a, you know, smallish but reasonable studio apartment somewhere, and then imagine, you know, 13,000 of them. Well, you certainly have a set of building equivalents, you know, just stacked up all around you. And in fact, I could only see over the containers if I went all the way up to the bridge, about 7 or 8 decks above the entry point to the ship.
And many of the ports that they go to are evolving to accommodate these gigantic ships. So could some of the more traditional ports that we sort of know and love and are part of our literature, could they become obsolete if they don't themselves increase in size?
Yes, they certainly could, and in fact, we've already seen that happen in many places. For instance, again, the advent of containerization in the 1960s meant that a lot of the traditional ports, think of Sydney's Circular Quay, for instance, were no longer viable for this new kind of traffic. They didn't have the kinds of crane systems needed, and ultimately, I think they couldn't accommodate the size of ship. Now we're seeing yet more displacements of shipping away from harbors such as Hong Kong or Singapore, which can still just about accommodate these ships, but up to new ports, for example, Port Kelang in Malaysia, where my ship stopped, simply because they have the space, they have the quayside, they can accommodate these ships.
Now, the fact that a professor of history found herself on board a cargo ship might have listeners wondering, but the main reason you were there is that you were undergoing research for your next book on the writer Joseph Conrad. He worked on cargo ships for years in the 19th century. Were you surprised at how different the experience was for you compared with what he went through?
Yes, I mean, of course, at the surface level, the contrasts are really what jump out. And again, this whole question of containers, the actual geography of the ports, the type of crew on board in certain respects, and the scale of the ship, all have changed quite notably since the 19th century. And yet, what I was struck by, and I suppose this was validation for my journey, I was struck by some of the continuities as well. And, you know, I think that in the digital age that we live in now, we're so used to thinking that things just kind of travel on different geographies. Indeed, sometimes they don't require much of a geography at all. But I think we forget about some of the very real spatial constraints that govern our world. So the Suez Canal, for example, is still the primary point of connection between the Mediterranean and the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean and the Pacific. That has not changed since it was opened back in 1869.
And did Conrad ply these waters that you went through? You know, where was he primarily sailing?
He absolutely did. Conrad, this was in fact one reason that I chose the itinerary that I traveled on. Conrad was based out of Britain, sailing on British ships, but he traveled primarily to parts of the Indian Ocean and indeed to Australia, to which he made numerous voyages over his career. He traveled extensively in Southeast Asia and indeed passed through exactly some of the waters that I was able to sail on a century later.
You do make the point that the ports he attended, and, you know, anybody who's read Conrad knows that the sheer Damon Runyon characters, the life, the vitality, just was oxygen to him. You found a very different port culture.
Yes. One of the consequences of the new types of ports that are outside older city centers is that they are essentially industrial sites. They're sites that are, you know, again, removed from a nearby city. They have an industrial sort of workforce that clocks in and drives cranes and clocks out and goes home. So you don't have that sense of the ship kind of arriving into the middle of a bustling, exotic city. Rather, you know, it's more like an airport experience, I would say. Ships only stop for somewhere between 6 and 24 hours, whereas in Conrad's day, they would stop for 6 weeks or longer to load and unload. And the kind of experience that sailors have on shore is thus vanishingly small. Often they don't even get off the boat.
Do they know what they're carrying on the ships?
No, it's one of the funny things to a lot of the people that I've spoken to about this, that nobody on the ship knows what is on the ship. And there is a manifest that lists the contents in some sort of general sense and definitely indicates whether there is hazardous material of different sorts, because this needs to be stowed in special parts of the ship. So the first officer does have this, but there is not enough detail for anybody on board actually to know what is inside all of these containers.
And just before we move a little bit more to the crew, the Indian Ocean that you travelled through is large. I mean, are you aware of other ships around you, or is there a sense of being quite alone? I'm particularly asking in the light of, you know, all of this attention that's been paid because of the search for the Malaysian Airlines flight, and just that reminder of the vastness and the solitariness of it all?
Yes, that flight story resonated with me as well for exactly this reason. The ocean is a gigantic place. We are very terra-centric in our perspectives, and we assume that, you know, it's easy to find anything anywhere in the world, but we forget that the majority of the world's surface is covered in water. That said, ships do travel on shipping lanes, by and large. This is partly because those routes are the ones that have been deemed to be the most efficient in terms of speed and fuel usage and so on, partly because of the currents that exist in the ocean that act as roads, and partly because of the technology involved in making sure, just as there are airplanes that are controlled by flying through certain channels, similarly ships have to be regulated so they don't have collisions or run-ins of different sorts. So we did see other ships, but often far afield, and it didn't take away from the sense of incredible vastness on the ocean.
My guest is Professor Maya Jasanoff. She's Professor of British History at Harvard, but she's written a very interesting piece in the New York Review of Books about a passage from Hong Kong on a cargo ship, an amazing experience that she had. What? Tell us about the crew. Who were they?
So the crew were divided into two populations. The ship is a French ship, and the officers were by and large French. So there were eight French officers on my ship, and the rest of the crew was overwhelmingly Filipino. The Filipinos are one of the big populations of seafarers in the present merchant marine around the world. And in addition to the eight French officers, there were 22 Filipinos on board, some of whom were officers, some of whom were able seamen, some of whom were the cook and the steward and so on. Now, this means there was a total of about 30 crew for a ship the size of which we've already discussed. Mm. It's a very small number of people operating this ship, and that's one of the things that I think I was most struck by, is the discrepancy, as it were, between this very small number of people and this gigantic moving object.
Which, with no doubt a hierarchy of pay rates.
Absolutely. I realized it was the closest that I've ever come to being in a sort of quasi-military setup. That is, there was a captain and there were officers and there was a very clear hierarchy, right down to the fact that there were two different areas in which people would have their meals or have their lounges. There's the officer's mess and the crew's mess, the officer's lounge and the crew's lounge. And so there was a very clear set of distinctions, both based on the rank of the people involved, but also, I found on board, based on the culture. Because on the one hand, you had this French population all speaking French together and who operate on three-month contracts. On the other hand, you have Filipinos who operate on nine-month contracts and have a completely different kind of experience, right down to the food that they eat.
What was the food like?
Well, the food was sadly pretty terrible. This is another point of continuity, I think, between Conrad's day and shipping now. Despite the fact there's a good deal of refrigerator space and freezer space on board, and there were some pretty good ingredients in these areas, the quality of the cooking left something to be desired, I must say.
Why do they do these jobs, both the French and the Filipinos?
Well, you know, for the French and the Filipinos, both, the pay is actually pretty good. You know, these are demanding jobs, in as much as, in particular, they require that you be away from your family for months at a time, very like the military. But for the French, I think the pay is pretty good, and the schedule on which they work is about 3 months at sea and then 3 months at home. And it turns out to be a reasonably appealing combination, at least for younger men. Most of the officers were quite young, in their 20s, and it still carries a bit of distinction. For the Filipinos, I was told by all of them that the wages that they earned on board were vastly higher than anything that they could get at home, and for them, therefore, it seemed worthwhile to leave home for 9 months at a stretch and send all this money home.
Is it safe? I mean, before I let you go, we have to talk about the Somali pirates. You obviously didn't experience that high drama, thankfully, of life on the oceans. But were you or the crew nervous? Is there an increased alertness when going through the part of the trip where they're known to be?
There certainly is. There are a whole range of precautions that are now accepted as standard best practices on ships, and our ship went through most of these. The element in the defense against pirates that I think most people are surprised by is that there are no armed guards on board a ship like this, and there's no weapons anywhere unless they're in the containers, in which case nobody would know. And so the precautions that are taken are all, you know, sort of defensive, but absolutely not armed in any way.
Yes, well, Maya, I'm very pleased that you enjoyed it, but that you're off it, actually. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for talking to me.
Maya Jasanoff, a professor of British history at Harvard University, with a very fresh take on scholarship, I think you'll agree. And you can book those trips that she referred to, by the way, through travel agents. They cost about $130 US a day. And that includes food, though from what Maya said, you might want to stock up. Anyway, thank you again for your company here on RN. Our summer production team is executive producer Jackie May and sound engineer Lila Schunner. Stay with Radio National throughout the weekend, and I'll be back next week with more Saturday Extra. The news is coming up next. Bye-bye for now.